Wow. Okay, that wasn't the most rabbinic thing I've ever said, but still, this is really incredible, and I get the privilege as one of your co-chairs of welcoming everybody, and I wanted to just share a couple of anecdotes. The first one occurred over 30 years ago. I was a rabbinical student here. And I was at the senior sermon of my colleague, Lori Foreman Jacoby. And she had asked Amy Eilberg to say a few words on that occasion. And Amy looked at Lori, and she offered the words, Achotenu atayi l'alfei rebaba, our sister, may you become a myriad of thousands. And in that moment, Amy took those words, those beautiful, ancient words from the Torah, and did what I think we do so well as Jews, we're good at recycling, and took a blessing that had a very specific meaning in the lives of women and the wishes and hopes and dreams for Jewish women at their wedding, on their wedding day. And for the first time in Jewish history, gave us the hope and the dream that our male colleagues had had for thousands of years, that we would have the opportunity to raise up disciples and students. Soon after, I was ordained, and I went to serve Congregation Am Yisrael in Northfield, Illinois, where I have been the rabbi for 25 years. I was very, very young when I was ordained. And then I blinked, you know. I blinked, and 25 years passed, and I, you know, you can read the wonderful stories that we've collected for the women that we're honoring today. My stories, I share many of the same stories with them, of the challenges and the struggle and the joy and how gratifying it is. I love being a rabbi. And I love being a rabbi in the rabbinical assembly. And so I'm here to welcome our female colleagues who've shared this journey together with me. But I also want to say something to our male colleagues who I count among my dearest friends. I've had the honor and the privilege of serving as an officer in the rabbinical assembly. And it has been incredibly gratifying because of the friendships that I've made. We share bonds with rabbis of many different denominations, but we share something with each other that is so deep and is so profound that it's above gender and geography, and I am so grateful to be counted amongst one of you, and so grateful that you are all here today. This is a sea change. That you are here and that we are all celebrating together, not apologetically, not quietly, not sensitive as to who may not share in this joyous celebration with us, but together. And we are incredibly grateful to be in a place, this place, at this time. I want to share one last anecdote, which is last year. I've been in Chicago for 25 years. I serve on the North Shore. And for all of those 25 years, I was the only female conservative rabbi serving on the North Shore of Chicago. And then, a little over a year ago, my new dear friend and colleague, Annie Tucker, arrived to be... be my next nearest neighbor, and while I consider her a friend and a colleague, I also look at her as really the next generation. And this idea that was maybe crazy, this crazy idea that women could be rabbis, which is really 25 years as long in my life, but a blip in the history of the Jewish people. And I got to see that this crazy idea was going to actually carry on to the next generation. Annie invited me to participate in her installation, which I did say to her at that time, I've been waiting for you for 25 years. And I thought about what I wanted to say to her that day on her bima. And I looked at her and I said to her, Achotenu atayil al-fei rebaba, our sister, May you become a myriad of thousands. So thank you all for being here with us today. We are grateful, our hearts are full, and we are grateful for our panel, and I'm now going to call up Bill Gershon, who's going to do the thank you part of the program.
Thank you, Deborah. On behalf of the entire Rabbinical Assembly, I want to express our appreciation to our committee co-chairs, Deborah Newman Kamen and Ellen Williams Fields. Let's express our appreciation to them. To their committee, Rabbi Joel Alter, Amy Eilberg, Nita Bieber-Feinstein, Alana Garber, Giancarlo Kaufman, Marion Shulevitz, and Gordon Tucker. Thank you all for everything that you have done. To the Rabbinical Assembly staff, led by Rabbi Julie Schoenfeld, Rabbis Carol Levithan, Ashira Konigsberg, Elliot Schoenberg, Bill Lebo, and our outstanding professional staff, Navi Ojeda, Max Arad, Emily Handel, and Juan Brown. Toda rabba for everything. I also want to express our appreciation to JTS for your hospitality, specifically to Chancellor Eisen, to Mark Gary for your friendship and your leadership and your partnership with the Rabbinical Assembly for making this conference possible. Thank you so much. The ordination of women as rabbis was one of the great watershed events in the development of halakha of the conservative movement. Indeed, one could argue that it was the watershed event in the history of the conservative movement. And I would add, it's wonderful, it's such a nice feeling to come together finally to celebrate one of the greatest achievements of our movement. This achievement opened up, in transformational ways, Judaism, not only to women, but created a new and vital spirituality for conservative Jews throughout the world. 30 years later, we gather here at JTS to celebrate the remarkable role women have made to the rabbinate, conservative Judaism, and the Jewish people. Those visionaries who sought this historic change did so out of personal and religious convictions based on their understanding of halakha and the moral and ethical imperative they believed was at the core of the Jewish tradition. And no discussion of the ordination of women can take place without mentioning the leadership and courage and vision of Rabbi Gerson D. Clone, of blessed memory, Chancellor of the Seminary. Rabbi Cohn led this transformational change. And for those of us who were students, as I was during those days, the issue of the ordination of women as rabbis permeated not only our experience here as JTS, but defined for many of us how a creative, responsive, and most importantly, authentic halakha could inform and transform Judaism for a new age. Dr. Cohn taught that every age needed to interpret Judaism afresh, that a halakha that became fossilized and unresponsive was not in keeping with the approach of the sages, and that conservative rabbis were the heirs to the authentic and dynamic halakhic voice within Judaism. During those years, I had the privilege to serve as his assistant. I could share many stories, but two stand out vividly. The first was right after the faculty vote to admit women into the rabbinical school. I was standing next to Dr. Cohn as he sat at his desk in the chancellor's office and placed a call to then chairman of the board, Stephen Peck, to tell him that the faculty had just voted to admit women. His voice was exuberant, but as he turned around to face me, his eyes welled up with tears because he knew at that moment he had changed Jewish history. The second story took place in Israel. I was with Dr. Cohn. It was Shabbos morning, and we were walking back to our hotel from shul. And on the way, a man yells out, "There goes the man who made women rabbis." Dr. Cohn, with a smile on his face and determination in his eyes, said to me, "Billy, if there's anything I've ever done that I believe in more, it's the ordaining of women as rabbis. We have done the right thing, and no matter what others will say, we have changed Jewish history and Judaism for the better." We are here today to declare that we indeed have changed Jewish history and Judaism for the better. And so today's session, we'll explore how has the ordination of women by JTS impacted the conservative movement and the American Jewish community. It is my pleasure now to introduce our moderator and panelists. Chancellor Arne Eisen, a man who needs no introduction, is one of the world's foremost authorities on American Judaism and has had an illustrious career as a scholar of Judaism and the leader and chancellor of JTS. Arne will moderate our session this afternoon. Elisa Doktoroff is president of the board of UJA Federation of New York. She previously served as chair of the board as well as chair of the Commission on Jewish Identity and Renewal. Elisa is a past president of the Abraham Joshua Heschel School and holds degrees from Harvard College, the University of Chicago Graduate School of Business, and JTS. And our next panelist, author and lecturer Blue Greenberg, has published widely on contemporary issues of feminism, orthodoxy, and the Jewish family, as well as other subjects of scholarly interest. Amidst a myriad of public roles, she chaired the first and second international conferences on feminism and orthodoxy and is founding president of the Jewish Orthodox Feminine Alliance. And last but not least, Francine Klagsbrun, a columnist for the Jewish Week, is the author of more than a dozen books. She was the editor of the first Ms. Reader and of the best-selling Free to Be, You and Me, created with Marlo Thomas and the Ms. Foundation. Francine was a member of the Commission for the Study of Women in the Rabbinate and at the forefront of the struggle to have women ordained as rabbis in the conservative movement. Let us welcome our panelists and Chancellor Eisen. Chancellor Eisen, I turn it over to you.
Thanks, Bill. It's my pleasure to welcome you all to JTS. You can imagine the honor I feel at sitting in the office where Gershon Cohen did that historic act. It's an honor for us to have you all here and celebrate what truly was an event in the history of the Jewish people and of Judaism. I am going to play a minimal role here. I'm going to, in a moment, pose a question to Francine. We had a conversation before this one. I'm going to pose one leading question to each member of the panel. Other members of the panel will then, if they want to, jump in response to that question. And then I'm going to pose one concluding question to all members of the panel. And then we're going to throw the floor open to you. But by common consent of the panel and the organizers, we'd like to do one thing first. This step that was taken seems in retrospect to be inevitable, but of course it wasn't. We'll be talking about that in a moment. And so we want to honor the group that did a lot to make it happen. We'd like to ask the members of Ezrat Nashim who are here to please stand and
not really Ivy's, was not that involved at that point. But then, when it was decided to have this commission to study the role of women in the bathroom, Gosin Kelm, who was one of my very closest friends, invited me to be on that commission. And at that time, I was also working on my book, Voices of Wisdom. And Voices of Wisdom is a compilation of biblical, Talmudic, Midrashic, etc. And it started occurring to me that you heard very few women's voices in this book. And then, when I sat on this commission, and the issue came up, of course, could women be rabbis? And what I wanted to talk about just a little bit, because you all know that it was a terrible time, you know, we could believe it, but we, on the commission, went around the country and spoke to people and got people's opinions, but we also asked for letters from people. And so I have in my desk, in my drawers, a pile of letters of people all over the Jewish community writing in what they believe, should there be women rabbis or not. A large percentage of them, surprisingly, said yes. They were mostly male who wrote in. A large percentage said yes. But a number, a good enough percentage, said no. And here were some of their reasons. One was, I am a rabbi. I don't think I could send an assistant rabbi out if she's a woman in a cold night to pay a shiver coupon. Another one was, well, you know, suppose we ordained women as rabbis. The male rabbis are not going to want to be on the BMO with them.
That's true.
And the Jewish community was the end of that. And another one, which was from a woman, which was my very favorite. She said, the fact is that women are smarter than men. I'm against having women rabbis because women are smarter than men. They do so much better at school than men do. And if we have women rabbis, the men are going to all fall by the wayside. There won't be any more male rabbis. But the fact is that that issue was an issue. It was an issue because the argument was when women get into a field, the field somehow is diminished. And then men don't want to be in that field. Teaching was always used as an example. Social work was used as an example. Well, today there are lots of male teachers, there are lots of male social workers, and there are lots of male rabbis. So I think it was the right decision for us to have made at the time. It was a struggle, there were meetings, there were people screaming and yelling at each other. But the majority voted for it, and we knew it was the right thing to do.
Can I just ask one brief follow-up, or was it a foregone conclusion?
No, very odd, I think. We had to swear. And as I say, Gerson Kahn was really my very dearest friend. And he was opposed to this at the beginning. His wife always said that it was my fault that he changed his mind. I hope so. We had to promise. That we would be absolutely open-minded, that if the halakha showed that women indeed were not allowed to be rabbis, we would have to vote against it. And we all promised this. And I knew in my heart that I was not going to keep that promise. Luckily, as we found out, there was nothing halakhic against it, and it had to be. It just had to be.
Blue, let's set anything up on this point.
This is too loud.
I will add that all that Francine described was observed and taken to heart by some. I would say a small percentage of women in the Orthodox community. The bulk of the Orthodox community remained pretty adamant against the idea, not even for the reasons that you suggested, Francine, but certainly it was unlike its reaction to the ordination of women in Reform Judaism. It was coming much closer to home, and so the steps taken within the conservative movement were taken seriously, if not nervously. Excuse me. And in terms of myself, I'll respond to how it impacted on me, all that was going on. It was very powerful. I began my journey towards affirmation of women rabbis with a very negative response to the ordination of Sally Prizan, and I watched, it took me, I would say, almost the better part of the 70s to come to observing her, but while I was observing her and changing my mind, much more important to me what was going on in the conservative movement, and particularly its fidelity to halakha, and that halakha was the basis of a decision, not a sociological decision, and even the arguments, the proponents and the dissidents, the conversation between the proponents and the dissidents, and the input of the community, which was very significant, certainly influenced my understanding of what the possibilities were within Orthodoxy. I have to say that in some ways, the Orthodox community took a similar journey. It just started and finished 2 decades later. So all that we are, all that we have in the Orthodox community in terms of women in the rabbinate, and we made tremendous strides in the last 2 decades, I have to say that we owe to conservative Judaism.
So, Blue, you've given us the segue to the question I'm going to pose to you. We're here to talk about impact. So let's think a bit more about the impact that this step inside conservative Judaism has had over the years on the Jewish community as a whole, and how the interaction, how did that impact take place? Is this personal interaction? Is this people watching from a distance and saying, well, maybe we should think of that? Is this opposition, which then gives way to opposition to the opposition? Tell us a little bit about the impact on
it. That's a good PhD thesis. And I think it actually is in order, a sociological analysis of this entire journey within all of the communities and the interrelationship between communities. So how do I react? I remember reading at the... I know for myself that it was various steps. I actually was surprised some years later to go back and look at Women in Judaism and realize it had been written over the course of the 70s. I think I finished writing it in 79, although it wasn't published for 2 more years. But then I never bring myself to say women rabbis. But I was moving along. I did say religious leadership. That was as far as I got. But by 1983, when I was invited by Rabbi Gordas, Rabbi Shalom, to participate in the Judaism discussion, I was already able to say women rabbis. But I said smicha. I said title. I said ordination. But I could not say pulpit. I expressly said not pulpit. But then there were these models around me. So the model, of course, was... The original model, I think, was Ezrat Nashim, the agenda of Ezrat Nashim, and then all that had taken place within the conservative movement, the RA, and the input of the United Synagogue, and the lay leadership. This was for somebody who had already experienced and understood some of the arguments against, and seeing such as Kavod HaTzibur, the honor of the community, and we haven't done this before, and we're going to diminish divinely established distinctive roles, gender roles, etc. Some of those arguments. I had already encountered many of those arguments in the Orthodox community in relation to women's tefillah, in relation to women reciting Kaddish, Kiddush, and so forth. So I think I could personally be more open to the positive arguments, positive halakhic arguments. I remember reading the Rosh Tshuva and being my eyes, reading it with eyes wide open in a very positive sense, and still feeling that personally I could take the step forward, even though if this was at odds with my own community. But I began to see signs in the Orthodox community. There were little signs. For example, there are time for an example or two. Okay. I remember speaking to a group of the scholars circle in Drisha in 1990, and by that time I'd come full blown to understanding women rabbis and proposing this for the Orthodox community and getting quite a hostile reaction. And these were women who were spending, you know, all their days learning, studying Talmud, and basically their response was, you know, don't taint us with these ideas. We're here learning Torah Lishma. In 2000, I was invited to speak to on a panel, and I remember Rabbi David Silber, head of Drisha, asking the audience whether how many of them, and the panel was about the ordination of women, and he said, how many of you students would consider it? And about 12 hands went up, which was about 25% of the audience. So there was a sea change in the 1990s, and I think one of the factors which you have just suggested is that the interaction, just seeing women rabbis, the growing number of women rabbis, seeing their names on the front page of the Jewish Week and writings by them, and having that title rabbi just changed a lot. In the Orthodox community, in 1993, the first public leadership pulpit role was at the Lincoln Square Synagogue with Rabbi Adam Mintz. Hired a woman, Julie Stern Joseph, to be congregational intern. She was doing the exact same job, except for leading the davening as the assistant rabbi was. But I'm sure that move was influenced by what was going on in the conservative movement as well. So there was a tremendous amount of interfaith. I'll just say one last thing, that I think there was a two-way street here. As much as those of us in the Orthodox movement were influenced by what was going on in the conservative movement, and as the community began to take in this idea, I remember at our first two Joppa conferences, we did have women rabbis from the other denominations, and even though we were threatened, we did not lose our sponsorship. That was a really big step for us. That wasn't done in the Orthodox community. But I think that the tremendous emphasis within the Orthodox community on women's learning, which is the way feminism implanted itself in the Orthodox community, had an influence on women in the liberal denominations. So I'm happy to say that it was the interdenominational impact was a two-way street, I believe.
Second, who said both on both sides of it, I felt very strongly that our rabbis influenced. Who used to say in 10 years we'll have women now and made up a nice woman? I said, yeah, yeah. And it is coming. But the one thing I do want to say, when you asked about halakhic before, when I was on this commission and since then, there have been people who testified to us, I mean great people, Mitrovsky, and so on, to show absolutely that there were no halakhic barriers for women rabbis. When I have gone to, and I can argue about this, but when I have gone to jail for conferences, I sit and listen to Orthodox authorities using exactly the same sources, starting all over again, ignoring the fact that we have discussed this, that this has been done and shown and so on. It's as if the conservative movement, it doesn't matter, it doesn't count. And so they start all over again, but it makes me feel good because it's the exact same text that we use, the same arguments, and it shows there is only one argument, as it were.
So we're going to continue the question of impact, and here we'll take it and broaden up to Jewish women leadership in the Jewish community in general, beyond the rabbinate, and also the way this was transmitted to the coming generation of women. not the generation of the founders, but the women who were watching them, perhaps thinking of, aha, I never thought that I could do this, or I always wanted to do this and never thought it was possible, but maybe it is. So let's talk about the larger impact of this decision to ordain women rabbis for the position of women in the Jewish community.
So just before I answer, and maybe this is part of the answer, I just want to say to Deborah that the blessing that you gave actually has come true. And I want to just say thank you to everyone in this room who has been involved in the development of the institution of the woman rabbi, in the creation and the enabling of that, because I think it has had enormous effect beyond the rabbinate in Jewish life in so many dimensions. So I really think that the fact that women were allowed, were enabled to take on the most central sacred role in Jewish life was a sea change in terms of Jewish life. I think it unleashed creative forces that had been held back for a very long time. And my God, we're talking about half of the population. So why shouldn't there be a tremendous unleashing of creativity that had been held back? And of course, we first saw it in synagogues. I experienced it. This is really a little bit through, this is all through my own lens. I'm not really speaking here as someone with tremendous, I am president of the UJA Federation of New York, but I don't have a PhD in this. So it really is through my lens. Women, the change that happened in terms of the participation of women in Jewish ritual life in synagogues had a tremendously empowering effect on how women felt they were as Jews, as women, as participants. I certainly felt it enormously inspiring to see and to participate in a very different way. I came from I grew up in a synagogue that was a conservative synagogue. I didn't have a bat mitzvah, but my bat mitzvah consisted of six girls on a Shabbat morning dividing up the Haftorah. And my part was the blessings after the Haftorah because my name began with R. I was the last one. It was very meaningful. I think the initial point is the synagogue, but I see concentric circles opening up from there. The leadership of synagogues, presidents of synagogues, founders of synagogues. Francine was the founder of a synagogue that I became a member of, and the founding president of that synagogue was a woman. So what I saw in that instance and many others was women leaders in the Jewish community stepping up and stepping in to create the opportunities that had not existed before. Needs that were unmet, of all kinds. Here at JTS, we now have the first woman chair of the board. So all of the institutions around the synagogue, the RA, Julie Schoenfeld, the institutions now of the synagogue being led by women, bringing their unique perspectives, their voice, their sense of what was needed that had not been supplied before. Beyond that, the organizations, the communal Jewish organizations. And again, this is my view. I worked with Robin Bernstein of the Educational Alliance for some period of time. She was interested. She was the executive director of the Educational Alliance, which is a legacy organization, community center on the Lower East Side. She was interested in figuring out how Jewish belonged in her agency. I think that would not have happened before, honestly. The I participated in significant ways in the establishment or the growth of the Abraham Joshua Heschel School. The leadership, the building of that school, which had a unique approach, I believe, to Jewish life, the egalitarian perspective of that institution, the inclusion of Jews from all walks of life, not just women, but inclusion of Jews from a broad perspective. That institution, when I was involved in it, was primarily led by women. The head of school was a woman. The presidents of the board, who I admired tremendously, who brought tremendous leadership skills and heart to the project, Virginia Bayer, Terry Krulwich, Shira Nadich-Levin, the daughter of a rabbi. They were exceptional leaders and tremendous models for me.
Shira Nadich was a big athlete, very much a big athlete.
That doesn't surprise me. And I will get to Federation. My involvement in Federation was really a function of my interest in the development of models and institutions and organizations that would promote Jewish identity. The people I encountered in the field of Jewish identity building at UJA Federation were women who I believe were influenced by the fact that there were Jewish women rabbis in the field. Eliza Kershan, Lisa Rubin Kershan is sitting here, absolutely a model and absolutely influenced by the availability of women's leadership in the rabbinic world. Rabbi Deborah Joselow, a rabbi, who is now the chair of the commission, the managing director of the Commission on Jewish Identity and Renewal. All of these women, tremendous role models, and I really sincerely believe very much affected by the change that had occurred that enabled them to step up, to participate, and to bring a new dimension to Jewish life that had not been there before. And then beyond that, organizations that were founded to support women. I want to note Shifra Bronsnick, sitting here also, and her Advancing Women Professionals, which has been a tremendous help. And thinking about the next generation, which you asked about, Moving Traditions. An organization that works with Jewish teens, with young men and young women, as they're thinking about the development of their identities. Who are they as young men and young women? What does Judaism have to say about the development of that identity? That's an organization that was founded by four women who were very much part of either in rabbinical school, considering going to rabbinical school, had been admitted to rabbinical school. They were all involved in the whole germinating world of women in the rabbinate, and for sure influenced by it. You know, I will say that in terms of the next generation, I think one of the things that is that the impact in terms of women in the rabbinate, I think is both about being inside the synagogue and outside it. There are so many rabbis who have taken their rabbinate to beyond the synagogue. And while I very much believe I'm a synagogue goer and very much moved and feel compelled by ritual, there are so many people out there who are not, and the ability of so many people, women, to reach out beyond and think about the needs of the young people and others, you know, not just young people, but to think of those beyond the synagogue, the needs of those, the creativity that's gone into the development of synagogues without walls, you know, and there are many examples of it, I think is tremendously hopeful for the next generation who are famously not coming in. And I think that's a tremendous, tremendous benefit of the creativity and the experimentation that I think a lot of women have done, both in the rabbinate and as leaders in the Jewish community in general.
That's a lot of food for thought here because, as you were beginning to speak, I was going to say, yes, but it was much different in terms of ordination, leadership, those other leadership. There's something different about you know, changing the religious precepts of the community, whereas the leadership of those organizations. But the more, you know, the so-called secular or communal organizations, but the more I thought about it is that there's certain irony here that, as you describe how much of an impact women, particularly women with carrying the title rabbi, have had on the general community, and yet at the same time, the expansion, the universe of women rabbis, at the same time that is going on, the problems in synagogue life have not gotten better, not for male rabbis and for female rabbis, and that, you know, the desire or the influence or the quest for a relationship with God or, you know, regular synagogue attendance or personal ritual, you know, those problems in the last 30 years have exacerbated, if that's the word I can use. So these two things are going on side by side. Which means that with the inclusion of women in rabbinic roles, that the core problems of synagogue life have not been, are not on, do not seem like they're on their way to resolution right now.
So, can I just have respond? I will say that's absolutely true, and I thought about that. Thought about that too, and you know, I think there are societal changes that are going on simultaneously, but that we have to deal with. But I see some hopeful signs in the development of by women rabbis. For example, Rachel Cowan, the Institute for Jewish Spirituality, I think is thinking about what is happening in synagogues or what is not happening in synagogues that needs to happen, and how to help rabbis think about those issues.
Yeah, maybe I was going to say maybe the infusion of women into inclusion or infusion of women into the rabbinate is going to heighten the. This I don't really want to say this. I think. The dilemmas and the decline, and that women's energies are going to push the whole focus away from the synagogue into other models, which is Pumfakir. How do you say Pumfakir in English? Or what?
Reverse.
Okay.
I'm going to take a little copy of you.
I don't think my view is so negative, actually. Maybe.
No, Lucy, how new is not negative, which is not. You're saying that women are looking for other experimentation or other ways of expressing themselves. But I want to just stress for a minute, how many women in synagogues now are reading Torah, are reading services? I mean, this was unheard of. And years ago, 30 years ago, we used to talk about, yeah, women should have Aliyah. Yeah, there's still a lot of synagogues where women don't have Aliyah. When I think about my synagogue, I don't know that it's so different than Aliyah. There are classes in Torah reading, and it's still women. And the women are loving it. And I think, if anything, is going to bring them back. I think that will. I'm there through it. I see that with my granddaughter, who doesn't go to shul that often, but she loves reading the Torah and reading services. And I think that there's a lot of hope for that, and that certainly would never have come about if we had not had our women rabbis to begin with.
So my question follows up directly on this point. Let's talk about the agenda now. Not foretelling the future, let's not try to be prophets. But if you had to name a couple things that we really have to do, and maybe specify the obstacles that are preventing us from doing them and how we'll overcome those obstacles, let's try to begin to formulate an agenda for the next 10 years. So hopefully we can all regroup a decade from now and see that we've made progress in this respect. Who wants to go first?
I want to say something. Yeah, exactly. No, what I want to say, because this is a conservative movement, and I think one of the things for the future, we said it in the past, but I think that we need to emphasize what is conservative Judaism yet again, because I don't think that that's been emphasized enough. I don't think that the younger generation knows what that really means. And I think if there's anything that, I'm not, this is not answering the women question, but it's answering the women in a sense. I think if there's something that rabbis need to be doing in the conservative movement, both women and men, is teaching what is this movement about. You know, the movement is gotten narrower, smaller, and everyone has all the sociological reasons, and the reform movement has moved to the right, and the Orthodox movement has moved not exactly to the left, but it's extending itself in that way. And people are saying, well, but there's no room for conservative movement. I think that's something this group, particularly, because this is a group of innovators, should be thinking about. And I'll get back to others.
So, jumping off something you said before, which is that now there are many, many women reading Torah, one of the things that I've observed is that there are many, many women reading Torah and many, many, many fewer men reading Torah. So if I look at my synagogue, for example, the people who are getting up there to read Torah on a weekly basis are mostly women. And I think this is not, you know, this is not something that I've only noticed. But I think that there are certainly more strides that women need to make in leadership of synagogue life and ritual life. But I think that that we need to have models of men and women really working together. In order to make sure that there are models for young men that are desirable and that they look up to and that they can aspire to, just as much as there are for young women. You know, now that there are women rabbis, there are young women who are aspiring to be rabbis and be involved professionally in Jewish life who are inspired by it. But I think we need to ensure that state, you know, there is a vibrant group of young men who also see this as a pathway for them.
I guess that letter that somebody wrote, that women are smarter than men, and the men aren't going to say that how big it's true.
So this is a quite complex issue and an interesting question. So certainly women's ordination represents an intensification of women's learning and commitment and spirituality and performance of ritual, and it's certainly added to the pool of talented religious leaders. When I was reading the bios, the stories in the program, the beautiful, really extraordinary program, it was nothing short of inspirational, and it will continue to be in my second and third reading of it. So the question is how to connect that to the masses, so to speak. It's the masses right now that are the problem. That remains the big question, how to connect those two dots. I certainly see that women rabbis have had a strong influence and connection to the people who come. And how do we get that, strengthen that, make that leap?
So what do you think about the masses? You talked about beyond conservative Judaism.
No, I'm talking about conservative
Judaism. Beyond rabbis?
Yeah,
across the board.
Across the board. Orthodoxy doesn't have that problem so much because of the power of the youth, but you know, we have in the Orthodox community, you know, observance of Hatz Shabbat, which is a whole issue now. You can, to what extent can you play your, some of the principles of day schools are saying the parents take your children's iPhones away from them on Friday so that they won't be violating, because they won't be observing Hatz Shabbat and so forth. But basically, because of the obligation and the sense of that it's a few that doesn't have that, the synagogues are pretty full. But I think the combination, but the larger part, like the Pew Report, the larger part of the Jewish community is interested in synagogue life and isn't interested in being nurtured spiritually. That's the real core of the problem. The other that Elisa mentioned is the whole question of tipping, which Francine cited it, but as something not to be considered, but I think Reform Judaism is dealing with this now as a serious issue. And I have to say that I've observed even in the partnership in Yanim, in Orthodoxy, that oftentimes there are more women present than men. Now part of that is single women who have a place to go, but part of it is also whatever happens when feminization of any institution or any profession, it's something that we have to understand a little bit better. I think it's time to do some statistics. Yes, what do we do as we go forward? One of the, I think maybe to get some more information. We have a lot of anecdotal material. I don't think we have a lot of studies of, for example, of 300 women. Is it 300 now ordained in the Church of Judaism? Is 300. It's an amazing number, 300. What do they choose? What professions? Have we done statistical analyses of what do they do mostly? And what is it women do? Are they choosing chaplaincy? Are they choosing hands-on? Are they choosing religious education? And how to work out time issues and family and child care issues. These are things that women who are coming after the Orthodox rabbinate are starting to ask as well. So I guess, some sort of studies that will give us some, why do men leave? Like moving traditions is trying to find out why young boys just don't show up anymore and what will keep them coming. So we're in the crosshairs right now of something big in the future for the future.
So we're going to do one of these participation now. There's a microphone over here, there's a microphone over there. I welcome you to come down to the microphone and ask questions. And while we're assembling, I thought I would say one thing now as the man up here on stage. On behalf of the male gender, speaking only for myself, I just want to say, I don't think we should underestimate the importance of the change that we're talking about for the Jewish experience, for the religious experience of men. And I have a lot of gratitude for that. And I thought of three things that are very obvious, but I think sometimes the obvious things need saying, so let me say them. One is that these insights that we would have been deprived of had we not had women speaking, women writing Torah commentaries, women doing scholarship, all of these things have enriched all of our Judaism immeasurably. And I can't imagine us without them. I mean, I can think of particular authors and particular books and particular ideas, but we would have been impoverished without that. The second is our experience of the synagogue. It's completely different. Again, it would have seemed stunted. I'm a person who seeks wholeness. One of the most meaningful lines that I know of in life is B'chol Levavcha, B'chol Nafshecha, B'chol Me'odecha. And that B'chol, like that allness there, rests on the participation of all the members of my community. and that only half the members of my community had been fully participating, I would have been deprived of the religious experience of the homeless, if I could call it that, right? And the third thing, and this is the most difficult to get hold of, but I'm sure it's right, our experience of God has been transformed. I don't think we're thinking of God in the same way as we would have if only men were speaking in synagogue, only men were dubbing in synagogue, only men were representing God in the Jewish community. So our notion of God has changed, nothing less. And we are sensitive to not being, you know, overweening in our claims for ourselves. We are the baby boomer generation who thinks we're the center of everything. I think in this case, something really crucial, not just the history of the American Jewish community, but the history of Jews, something crucial to the history of Judaism has happened, and that's what we're celebrating.
This is really just an anecdote, but it sort of picks up on men and Orthodoxy women. There was some event in our synagogue, and my granddaughter, who was 16, was there. And as I said, she loves the Gabbai and the Torah and so on. Haskell Goldstein, who was an Orthodox rabbi, was there. And he's a good friend of ours. And he came over to be introduced, and I said, granddaughter, she's now studying with a tutor to learn all the liturgy from Yom Kippur, from Rosh Hashanah, and everything. But I don't know, she thinks maybe she should go out and make money that way, whatever. And without missing a beat, Haskell said, well, you know, I have a tape out, and the tape, which he does, which is wonderful, has all the Musafim, of all the holidays. You know, I'd love you to get that tape and look at it. And I thought to myself, imagine this, imagine an Orthodox rabbi is taking it just for granted that this young woman, of course she's going to do these services. Well, that is a sea change in and of itself.
I am Carolyn Braun, class of 88. And I love all the things you say, and thank you for them. It's hard for me to see really what the huge impact of women in our movement has been. At least the irony is in the synagogue. And which is when I came to the seminary, I was sure I was not going to work in a synagogue. And lo and behold, I've been in one for 20 years. And there's a couple of things. First of all, I do want to thank the seminary for having brought us in and for bringing in gay and lesbian rabbis also. That the seminary felt that they finished their job as soon as they signed that piece of paper. And that we came in and we became just one of the gang. And certainly, I've been so impressed with my younger colleagues who are doing these amazing things. And I'm impressed with also my colleagues who are also doing amazing things. So excited to be a rabbi and in that first class and in the synagogue. Mainly, we are just great for the synagogues. They can pay us less, we will work harder, we will be as spiritual as they want. And as soon as finances are bad, they'll figure out some way to take care of that. And if I were going to give our movement some advice, I would say really to put some energy into really looking at synagogues for men and for women. And really think of what it's like to not have that institution, because I really think synagogues are going to be dead in a few years. You know this stuff much better than I do. But from my standpoint, they're not bringing in new blood. And so they bring in a woman, and we end up being the same as everybody else. So those are my thoughts. Thank you.
I'm the Associate Dean of the Senior School of Urban Studies in Los Angeles. And I also loved what you said, and my question really revolves around how to help rabbis and congregations in particular think of about placement of women and or other people who are considered at risk that I think are an outgrowth, gays and lesbians, those of a certain age in today's world. And so my question really is, what advice would you give to rabbis, women, and others who are encountering unintended bias in their search? And also, the flip side of that, what do you think we can and or should be doing within the communities to help build an awareness that the professional opportunities for women and other groups should match the wonderful opportunities that you spoke of women being in the communities?
The only thing, I can't answer, I don't know the specific of that, but I will say this. I think women have to make an effort to, they've made a great effort until now, but to be courageous, to put your sticky necks out. For example, when I was in the garden looking for a new rabbi, because our rabbi retired, there was not one woman applying, and I was just stunned. This is a, you know, a synagogue here in Manhattan, a good synagogue. Why were there not women applying? Somebody said, oh, well, you know, that rabbi was so terrific, I don't want to be the one who goes after him. That's not a good reason. And I think maybe something in the training has to be said that you have to take a chance, and even if you get rejected, you have to take a chance. That's the only thing I can look at.
So, I don't have a great answer to this either. But I imagine, I don't know what the RA is doing. I think, you know, rabbinic organizations that serve rabbis should be thinking about how to serve them better, men and women. To the extent that these are issues for women, I think the organizations that serve rabbis need to be thinking about how to do that better. There are also, you know, I'm going to point out Schiffer again, but there are organizations that are thinking about how women, how to advance women professionals in the Jewish community. That includes rabbis. It's not exclusive to rabbis. But, you know, some of it is about change of institution, but some of it is about the women themselves and giving them the tools to be able to address the issues in the spaces in which they are.
Well, I have a question and a comment. My question is, what percentage of the 300 women choose the pulpit, choose synagogue life, and what percentage, what are the other primary choices? That's my question. And the second, Elliot here. Is Elliot Schoenberg in the room? Just stepped out. Okay. We actually, in preparation for this conference, went through every single file in the RA to do these statistics. And there's some wonderful statistics that came out of it, including, and especially, I mentioned this earlier, when you look at the innovation of our women colleagues. So you look at these new kinds of kehilot that are being created, and new social justice organizations, and new innovations in chaplaincy. When you put together all of the women who are in congregational life, you have, and this is why I'm looking, Elliot, there you are. we have Elliot 30% in pulpit, and then there was another 9% in education and congregations. Right, so it came to 40% in the congregational setting, 9% of whom are in, you know, synagogue schools, senior educators in congregations, in charge of all of the, you know, variety of educational roles. So it's 40% of the women altogether. Yeah, sure, I can compare it.
And if you may, that's about 10%.
Yeah.
It's not, I don't know whether that's... It's probably a little bit closer to 50% than 40%, and I don't know if that's statistically significant or not.
Those including schools,
too? Yes. If you added schools, yes.
What is the other 60% of women rabbis? How does that break down?
I can't give you all of them. The second largest group is in Jewish education. And that we have specific, I think the specific percentages, I still have them in my head. 20%, and it's then chaplaincy position. But what was significant to us is that by far and away, women in the synagogue environment is, which doesn't appear to be like what the press says, but it's really significantly true. Chaplaincy, education, and there's a nice split, so to speak, about women who do two other things, probably more than men. One of which we would call authors. We think the numbers are nine or ten, and it's growing, blogging, writing books, writing or living, contributing to Haaretz and other things. And then a whole other group, which Julie coined this really nice kind of expression we call educator at large, where women put together a number of part-time gigs where they would teach at one synagogue school, teach at another synagogue school, and do bar mitzvah tutoring. So there's some kind of potpourri of part-time positions. So they have a hand in it, but it's part-time.
Yes.
Do
you want to say something else? Okay. Please.
Hi, Nadav Predator from the Congregation in Tivot Shalom in Berkeley. So I wanted to point out that the tone that the bill set when this began was one that I imagined wasn't going to be possible when the first decision came down. And to celebrate the ordination of women as rabbis, as opposed to include women as rabbis, is a very different kind of framing. And so I imagine that, and it was delivered in a servant way, but when Danny Tortis wrote his article, Positive Historical Judaism Exhausted, in Conservative Judaism, the journal, where he wondered whether or not the ordination of women could become an inescapable horizon, using the philosopher's, education philosopher's term, because it would bring us together and remind us who we are. I wonder if that has become a new assumption within the conservative movement to be proud of the ethical advances within halakha that we make, because that would require a very different stance when it comes to LGBT inclusion, when it comes to women's placement questions, when it comes to questions that might come up later. If we celebrate the decisions that we make, I imagine that that challenges older assumptions about pluralism and where a halakha in the position where it was before stands in the halakha today. So I'm wondering if we could think about that a little bit.
And one thing we didn't really mention was saying, you know, women are in congregation. The chaplaincy has grown and become such an important thing because of women that I don't think we may have mentioned that really, the importance of the chaplaincy, which was like nothing years ago. You know, there were no Jewish chaplains, there were Christian chaplains. And I know this because of Sam Faxon, my husband, was very involved in starting many of these chaplaincy projects. So we're celebrating. I think we should celebrate. That's one more thing.
I just want to say that I would love to hear Army respond to that question.
I want to take it. I think not, my brief response is it's generational. Absolutely, it's generational. That without any data, I would anecdotally say that the younger generation does celebrate, takes it for granted, and celebrates. And there are a lot of conservative Jews and a lot of conservative rabbis who are unfortunately still looking over the shoulders at Orthodoxy and saying, can we really do this? Are we less legitimate because we're doing this? Are we less authentic? Like, do we really have the right to do this? And it's a good thing. The more the Orthodoxy affirms this, the better those kind of conservative Jews will feel about it. But I think celebration is very much the tone. And when you speak, as I did last night in Thousand Oaks, California, to an audience of conservative Jews who want to know what conservative Judaism stands for, this is what conservative Judaism stands for, right? Not the quality, how we do it. This is what conservative Judaism stands for. Yes?
Jesse Olitsky, Congregation of Bethel in South Marsh, New Jersey. To piggyback on Manhattan's, the end of this question, actually, and hoping that our panelists and Chancellor Eisen, as moderator, you as well will answer this. If this is what conservative Judaism stands for and celebrates, we would think understanding, appreciating pluralism, a diverse spectrum, all that, that it's then problematic 30 years later that in this institution where we celebrate this, we still have a non-egalitarian union, and we still have non-egalitarianism in the different aspects and facets of our movement, in our camps, in our schools, that sort of thing. So looking at the future of the movement, how do we address that as we continue to celebrate this?
Egalitarian
is egalitarian,
and this movement
should be thoroughly
egalitarian.
Hi, I'm J.B. Sack, from Dave High School in West Hills, California, and Congregation on Beyond in Victoria, California. I don't have as much of a question as more of a comment that you may or may not wish to address, but I think there are at least three areas that were maybe that the ordination of women has affected, had a big effect on that weren't really explored enough or at all. One is, I think, it presented opportunities for some interfaith cooperation and dialogue, and that there were discussions between women and men and women about ordination, and then just about how we process and think, and I think there's a lot more positivity about how religions work and how we can work cooperatively that are still built in on those early discussions that women of different faiths had about ordination of women and the role of women in their various faith communities. Secondly, it's for me as a male, it's not only that the presence of women and their capacity to create wonderful scholarship or give sermons have enriched my life, but I think that the presence and dialogue has allowed me and enabled me to open up parts of myself, my brain and my soul, that I would definitely not have done, would not have been channeled, explored, allowed, or nurtured without the glorious presence of my women colleagues and teachers. Above that, I think that the whole process of discussion and debate around the inclusion of women was also about what is the measure of human dignity within Judaism. And for those of us that were sort of on the margins as queer Jews and others, the idea that there might be people who took human dignity seriously and that might care and respect for women gave a lot of us hope that we might be respected and cared for as well. Capacity to care and contribute would be eventually welcomed in a place opened up where we could be part of a larger shining world where we, as Jews, work to make Tikkun Olam effectuated and a reality. And I think that that really hasn't been opened up enough as well. Thank you.
Second question. I have to warn you all that we have a hard stop at 5 o'clock, unfortunately. This is great, but we have to stop at 5.
Hi, I'm Rachel Haynes, a rabbi at Sutton Place Synagogue here in Manhattan. I have a few comments and a question. First, in response to Francine, your comment about when your synagogue was going through a search that there were no women applicants and that women should sort of step forward and put themselves out there and you didn't say deal with it, but deal with whatever comes. I think that a lot of us have done that, and the question of how many women are in the pulpit currently is not necessarily a fair question because it doesn't show how many women applied for jobs. It just shows how many women, especially in senior positions, it doesn't matter the size, but of senior positions. So I think we need to remember, I can tell you that in the job searches that I've gone through, unfortunately I've been blessed to be at Sutton Place Synagogues, I have consistently been asked, what am I going to do when my kids get sick? how am I going to be on the beam with men? What am I going to do if a man or a woman doesn't want to come to me? I know that my male colleagues, at least the older ones, did not get those questions. And so it just knocks you down to hear that, and it makes you wonder, do I actually want to apply for a synagogue that has been in this standard conservative movement, which makes me look at the article in the Washington Post several weeks ago, which celebrated so many of our colleagues, our female colleagues here, who went out on their own and developed incredible new initiatives. And I wonder, I haven't asked them, did they do it as a result of, or regardless of how they felt, conservative synagogues might have been a part. And when we were talking about numbers before, how many women are in the pulpit, and then we started talking about part-time and education and chaplaincy. So we got off the rails. Last week at Park Avenue Synagogue, with 500 people in the room, there were 12 rabbis reading the Declaration of Independence on the Bima. I was the only woman. And I think that we need to be honest about the fact that women are not yet 40%, certainly not in any business.
Sorry to say, we are going now to have to conclude with a closing round of comments by our panelists. Who would you like to begin?
So I wanted to say that despite some of the critical comments I raised, I think it just caused for great celebration. I came here feeling so privileged to be here and celebrate with all of you. And I'm thrilled to have them at this time when this has happened. I'm really fortunate to be in this moment of Jewish history and what an impact the conservative movement has had on all of this. And as I reflected on the timeline, I saw the ups and the downs, and you know that we were all at, you know, we were in transition. I thought that's how it happened. It happened with a step forward, a step backward, push back, two steps forward. That was the jagged line and timeline in the program. And that's maybe this is one of those pushback times, and it's going to, you know, move forward rapidly. I also think that the ordination of women was just a major increment of social justice and an upgrade of Judaism in general. Somebody said the human dignity element is a very powerful part of that. So, but at the same time, I am concerned about the reports here, there, and everywhere about the diminution of the identity. And I'm wondering now, I think these new initiatives that coexist right now with synagogue life are very important, and women are bringing their creative energies to a lot of those new initiatives. And I'm wondering about this, because I think it reflects on synagogue life too. Are these new initiatives making more demands on Jews, more ritual, more celebration, more intensive, more learning? Can you look at these new initiatives and pluck some patterns out of them? And if so, does that signal that maybe our synagogues should be more demanding rather than less demanding, more intensive?
So I want to echo what Lou said about celebration. I think this gathering of celebration is very important. And we have to remember what has been achieved, even though, as Rachel said, there really is a tremendous amount that needs yet to be done. And I think, you know, just on the response a little bit more to your question, statement really about what's going on out there, that I think we have to do a better job of trying to train people and boards and those who are involved in the leadership of synagogues what is permissible and what is not.
Yes.
I actually think that the experimentation is the experimentation that has taken place
outside of synagogue is a good thing, and I think we need to do more of it, and we need to figure out how that impacts or how that, what that has to say about what life is like in synagogues. What can be brought to bear, what we learn outside by experimentation, because I think we can't stay the same. I think we're getting too many messages that what we're doing is not working. And I don't want to give up on saying that, but I think experimentation is definitely an important thing that we have to do. And so I encourage more of it and more sharing of what the learnings are from that experimentation.
I just want to speak very personally. For me, it was one of the great privileges of my life to be instrumental in helping women to become rabbis. And I am very grateful for it, and I thank all of you for that. But yes, there are always problems. You know, things change, things develop. We're moving in one direction now. We were moving 30 years ago. Who could have imagined where we were? Who could imagine this? Who could imagine 40% of rabbis being women? Who could imagine women not only having LAL, but meeting services and doing all the things they do? So I'm not pessimistic. I think we're in one phase now. We will experiment, we will change, we will develop. There will be a new kind of synagogues as are developing now. But I think the core will be there. And I think, I will say this again, I think the core of conservative Judaism is tremendously authentic, tremendously important. It has not diminished with time. And I think part of the job of this group and of these women and men is to convey that message.
Let's thank all the members of our panel one last time.
Thank you to all for your insights and your foresight and all that you do. And Chancellor Eisen, I just wanted to tell you, I think Rachel took the words out of my mouth before. You said before that as the only man sitting here, welcome to many of our worlds. But that's changing for those of us who happen to be female and are a rabbi. So thank you very much to all of you.